come now to oral questions. The first in the name of Miles Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent announcements has she made about the budget operating allowance?
The Honourable Nicola Willis.
Mr. Speaker, in the budget policy statement yesterday, I announced that the operating allowance in budget 2024 would be less than $3.5 billion. The operating allowance is the amount of money allocated in the budget to fund new spending and revenue initiatives. To put this amount in perspective, the operating allowance on average across the past four budgets was around $4.5 billion. In budget 2022, the allowance was around $6 billion. And in budget 2023, it was $4.8 billion. So the budget we will release on 30th of May will be significantly tighter than those in the immediate past, and it will also contain personal income tax relief for hardworking New Zealanders.
Supplementary. When will she announce the operating allowances for future budgets?
Mr. Speaker, as I said in the budget policy statement, the operating allowances for budgets 2025 to 2027 will be set out in the Fiscal Strategy Report, which is one of the budget documents. Operating allowances for future years are planning assumptions that improve the accuracy of fiscal forecasts. They are often amended and revised over time. To give the House one historical example, the operating allowance for the most recent budget in 2023 was announced as being $2.6 billion in budget 2020, but as the years went by, was raised to $2.7 billion, then to $4 billion, then to $4.5 billion, and then to $4.8 billion, some $2.2 billion more than indicated 3 years earlier. That is why I take any comments about future allowances with a large grain of salt when those comments come from the Labor Party.
Supplementary, Miles Anderson.
What reaction has she had to the budget policy statement?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've seen many positive comments on the BPS. However, someone did accuse me yesterday of refusing to provide a concrete budget allowance in the BPS and said, oh, it's highly embarrassing for a finance minister to be unable to do what has been required of every finance minister since the introduction of the Public Finance Act. Mr. Speaker, that assertion is wrong. The Public Finance Act does not require anything from the finance minister with regard to budget allowances, and in fact makes no mention of budget allowances whatsoever. What is highly embarrassing is for someone to publicly accuse a minister of breaching an Act of Parliament while getting basic facts wrong. And I am disappointed in the opposition spokesperson, Barbara Edmonds.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Megan Woods.
Sorry?
The Honourable Megan Woods.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
You know yourself, yes.
Supplementary. Is it correct that the reason that she has broken the convention of providing an operating allowance in the budget policy statement is because coalition budget negotiations have broken down or coalition partners can't agree?
No, Mr. Speaker, that's another one from the Labor Party fantasy file, the same file they get their idea that a new tax will somehow make New Zealand more prosperous. And Mr. Speaker, in fact, what we have here is a party that had a very strong convention. The Labor Party's convention was every time they said they'd stick to a spending limit, the next opportunity they had, they broke it. Well, Mr. Speaker, this government's going to break that convention.
Supplementary.
Miles Anderson.
Thank you. What other feedback has she seen?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I did have another quite different reaction to the BPS yesterday. I received a lovely email from someone whose name I will protect for her privacy, but I do think the House would benefit from hearing this as it represents a point of view that is often missing in the media commentary. And this is what the email said. I thank you, the National Party and the Coalition Government, for promising to honour the tax cut. It is a way to help the squeezed middle, and especially mature singles who are often forgotten. I am one of them, with a mortgage on one average income to spread across many bills. It is difficult out there for people like us. For once, I feel like the unseen can get some relief, whatever the amount. Really appreciated. And yet the members opposite would take it from her.
Question number two, in the name of the Honourable Priyanka Radhakrishna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Minister for Disability Issues. Did the reports she received from FICAHA that she referred to in her answer to question number four yesterday contain figures of those who use disability support funding for pedicures and massages, or did they just contain anecdotal evidence?
The Honourable Penny Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The report contained advice from the Ministry which outlined that the uses of flexible funding that FICAHA would pause are for a range of services, including, quote, self-care services such as massages, hairdressers, pedicures and other appearance or therapeutic services that some carers have accessed as part of carer support or individualised funding. I have received further advice from officials that the evidence FICAHA relied on in making the decisions to clarify what funding could be spent on came from a range of sources, including analysis of spending data, concerns raised directly with FICAHA by providers, including individualised funding and choice in community, living hosts and needs assessment, and service coordination organisers on what funding was actually being spent on, and feedback directly from the community. I have also been advised by officials that expenditure information from providers indicates that in a number of instances, individualised funding has been used to purchase lotto tickets, alcohol and tobacco. Clearly, the system set up under the previous government did not have appropriate settings in place.
Point of order. Point of order. Mr. Speaker,
point of order, Dr. Duncan Webb.
If I heard the Minister correctly, in response to a written question, she expressly quoted from a document, and I would request that she table that document.
Is the Minister quoting from a document she has in the House? No.
Thank you. Don't have it in the House with me, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Priyanka Radhakrishna.
Can she confirm that at least 26,000 carers currently accessing carer support through FICAHA will be impacted by the changes announced on 18th March?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I can confirm that carers that were accessing the funding for care services such as massages, hairdressers, pedicures and other appearance or therapeutic services, or for purchasing lotto tickets, alcohol or tobacco, will be impacted.
What advice did the Minister receive prior...
Excuse me. Just wait. Your own team said a little unsettled. Carry on.
What advice did the Minister receive prior to 18th March on the number of people in total who would be impacted by the changes that were announced on 18th March?
As I said, I received a range of information, and the numbers certainly were not fully explained that would be impacted, but that is because the vast majority of carers use their support for assisting in their care of their disabled loved ones. And those carers do an absolutely amazing job, and they should not be being impacted by a very small number of people who are using it for the purposes that I've outlined.
Did the Minister or her office sign out, as part of this report or any other report, wording that was used in FICAHA's announcement of the 18th March changes?
FICAHA advised me that they had a comprehensive engagement and communication plan in place. Clearly, that did not happen. I have apologised that did not happen as did the CE of Faikaha.
Point of order, the Honourable Kieran McNulty.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. That question was very specific about whether the Minister had signed out a briefing that then appeared on the website. That answer did not address that specific question.
Well, I think it did address it because it talked about a process that the Minister was aware of in relation to the question. Well, members can shake their heads all they like. I'm sitting here listening to it. I listen to the questions, I listen to the answers. I think we'll move on.
Ask it again.
Can I ask it again?
Part of whatever your allocation is, use it up as much as you'd like.
Did the Minister or her office sign out as part of this report or any other report wording that was used in Faikaha's announcement of the 18th March changes?
Faikaha advised me that they had a comprehensive engagement and communication plan in place. Clearly, that did not happen. That is why I have apologised, and that is why the CE of Faikaha apologised.
Last week, when I asked a question about whether the Minister signed out a report and she didn't answer it, your ruling was that her answer didn't get close to the sign-out bit of the question.
Sorry. Start again. Sorry, there was noise here. I couldn't hear.
I'm just seeking your guidance, Mr. Speaker, because last week I asked a very similar question about whether she signed out a particular report. The Minister didn't get close to answering or addressing that question, and when I put that to you, you did request that she have another go at answering that question.
Well, I might have. That was last week. This week, I just heard the Minister say what she was advised of. It may not satisfy the member who's asking the question, but it does address the question. Is there another supplementary on this? We'll move now to question number three in the name of Mike Buttrick. Point of order, Kieran McNulty. Honourable Kieran McNulty.
Mr Speaker, I know that you go to great lengths to ensure consistency in approach and question time. The difficulty we have there is that in one occasion when you saw fit to ensure the Minister responded specifically to the question about whether she signed a briefing, this time the question is pretty much the same. If the question was, has she received advice, of course that would have been addressing it, no question. But on two occasions she was asked whether she had signed a briefing, which of course is different to receiving advice, and on both occasions she simply said she received advice.
Yeah, I would have thought the inference in that was enough, but if you also look at 2072, you'll see that that's not my role to judge the performance of a minister. It is to simply ask the question, has the question been addressed? And my judgment is it has. Mike Buttrick.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education. What recent reports has she seen about student behaviour in classrooms?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Erica Stampin.
Mr Speaker, a report published by the Education Review Office this morning showed that behaviour in New Zealand classrooms is amongst the worst in the OECD. This report tells us an important story about what is happening in our society that is mirrored in our classrooms. It gives us the evidence that we need to make important changes to support our principals and our teachers, including the ones we've already made to better support our hardworking teachers.
Supplementary. Mm-hmm. What action has the government already taken to improve behaviour in classrooms?
Mr Speaker, the report said that 51% of teachers mentioned device use reduced the ability to concentrate and may be one of the causes of worsening behaviour. We've already taken action to ban cell phone use in our classrooms, and the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. Feedback from Hornby High School was that they have had no reports of cyberbullying since the ban was introduced. So we know the effects of this policy on behaviour is already having positive impacts. We will take the recommendations in the report and see what further we can do to support our hardworking teachers.
Supplementary. What can we do to better support our teachers when it comes to student behaviour?
Mr Speaker, the report stated that less than half of new teachers reported being able to capably manage behaviours in the classroom in their first term. A significant number of teachers feel demoralised and are considering leaving the profession. I know that from talking to principals and teachers that initial teacher education is a key solution to helping our teachers manage behaviours in the classroom. Initial teacher education is a priority for this government, and we are already looking at what changes we can make to help better manage student behaviour.
Supplementary. What comments has she seen on this report?
Mr Speaker, Ruth Shinoda from the Education Review Office said this morning, we need a national approach to how we manage behaviour in our schools so our kids can get the best out of their education. We need to increase support for teachers alongside setting clear expectations from all of us about what good behaviour looks like so we can prevent and respond to this challenge effectively. I agree with Ms Shinoda that we need a more nationwide, consistent approach to what behaviour is acceptable and what consequences there are for unacceptable behaviour. We want to support principals with minimum standards that are consistent across the country so that there is agreed and widely understood expectations in this area.
Question number four, Cameron Luxton.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Justice, Firearms, is it important that licensed firearm owners take the time to revise the rules of firearm safety over the coming months?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Nicole McKee.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. With the first cold snap of the year about to hit New Zealand, many deer hunters are keenly anticipating getting out and about in the backcountry in search of roaring stags this long weekend. As licensed firearm owners, it is our responsibility to ensure that before we hit the hills in search of rutting deer, we have revised the rules of firearm safety. Understanding and adhering to these rules is crucial to prevent incidents and ensure that everyone has an enjoyable time in the outdoors.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. Of the seven basic rules of firearm safety, which is the most important?
Mr Speaker, all of the seven rules of firearm safety are important. However, during the roar, rule number four, identify your target beyond reasonable doubt, is mainly the one to be emphasised. Failure to properly identify a target could lead to tragedy. No matter how experienced a hunter is, they should take their time to keep a clear head and treat every roar as if it's coming from a fellow hunter, because it very well could be.
Supplementary. What advice would she give licensed firearm owners who are travelling with firearms this raw season?
Mr Speaker, it is important that licensed firearm owners follow the guidelines for the storage and transportation of firearms and ammunition to the letter. These guidelines have changed significantly over the past couple of years, so it's important that licensed firearm owners revise them again and understand what their new requirements are.
Supplementary. What other points would she like to make regarding firearm safety this raw?
Mr Speaker, treat every firearm as loaded and pay attention to the firing zone. After properly identifying a target and before firing, a hunter should ask themselves, what could happen if I miss? Hunters need to be sure of what is in between them and their target and what is beyond. A solid backstop is a must. Good luck out there to everybody who is going to be hunting during this roar, and stay safe. As the old saying goes, it's better to go home with no meat than no mate.
Well done. Question number five, Dr. Aishel Verrill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Hang on, sorry. Ready?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Public Service and asks, does she agree with Nicola Willis's promise in 2023 that no cuts will be made to any frontline services?
Mr Speaker, I often agree with Nicola Willis, although I have observed that from time to time she does fall short of perfection. I would like to add some additional context to her comment for the member. The Coalition Government is focused on shifting resource from the back office to frontline services. And in making that commitment, we are not committing to doing things the way they have always been done. We are not going to ban ourselves from looking at other ways we could do things better or differently to ensure the resources we're employing have a bigger impact for the people we're seeking to serve. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, I anticipate that in some cases where our government reprioritises resources from back office functions, that member and her colleagues will mischaracterise it as a cut to frontline services. They will be wrong, Mr. Speaker, but their political motivations are clear.
Supplementary. What evidence has she seen that assures her that proposed job cuts at the Ministry of Health won't impact the government's ability to respond to public health emergencies?
Mr. Speaker, I have seen the guidelines that were provided to all agencies when they were asked to identify reprioritisation and savings measures, and I have spoken with the Minister of Health about his expectations in relation to his agency and his view that we need resources in our hospitals, in our emergency rooms, immunising our children, and I agree with his priority.
Supplementary, what evidence has she seen that assures her that proposed job cuts at the Ministry of Primary Industries won't impact the government's ability to respond to biosecurity emergencies?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this could get a bit repetitive. However, I have seen the clear guidelines that were given to government agencies about the proposals that they would put forward for savings. Furthermore, in the case of MPI, I have been assured that MPI is not proposing any reductions to its frontline services and that statutory staff, such as veterinarians, animal welfare, fishery, food compliance officers and biosecurity teams at the border, remain. The primary sector can have confidence that MPI's key functions, including biosecurity, food safety, forestry and fisheries, will not be compromised by the proposed changes.
Supplementary, what evidence has she seen that assures her that the safety of children or prisoners or prison staff will not be impacted by cuts to support services at Oranga Tamariki or corrections?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have sat down with the Minister for Oranga Tamariki and its Chief Executive, and I have been assured by them that actually they are looking forward to the opportunity to ensure more of our resources are focused on supporting vulnerable children and that less of our resources are focused on middle management.
Mr. Speaker, has the Minister interrogated the assurances of the chief executives that she cited in response to two of the preceding supplementary questions by requesting evidence that that is the case? And if not, why should New Zealanders believe her claim that no cuts are being made to frontline services?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm getting a bit of a flavour for what the last regime might have been like, interrogations and evidence. But actually, that doesn't at all marry up with what we saw in practice, does it? Which is that spending got completely out of control, resources were tied up in the back office, the headcount in public agencies exploded, and New Zealanders were left wondering if spending's increased by 80% in just 6 years, what have we, the people, got to show for it? Well, the member's right. There's a different government in charge now with a different approach, and we're going to drive value for those taxpayer dollars.
Question number six, Tiana Tiana.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and Reeds. What advice, if any, has she seen on the impact of the government's coalition agreement on workers?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Brooke Van Belt.
Mr. Speaker, I've already delivered two of the commitments from the ACT National Coalition Agreement in my portfolio to repeal the Fair Pay Agreement system and expand the 90-day trials to apply to all businesses.
I've also implemented a moderate annual increase in the minimum wage as required by the National New Zealand First Coalition Agreement. In each case, I've received a regulatory impact statement from the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, which included mentions of the impacts on workers. I consider and appreciate the advice I receive from officials on all fronts, but I also consider a wider range of views when forming my policy decisions.
Supplementary. Will she guarantee that workers will be able to continue to clarify their employment status in the employment court?
Mr. Speaker, I have only received very early policy scoping advice on contracting arrangements, so the member will have to wait for further policy decisions to be made. But one thing that's very clear from the coalition agreement's intentions is that this government intends to clarify the law to make certain for both businesses and workers what are employment or contracting arrangements.
Supplementary, is it correct that she will not promise workers that they will continue to have the right, as they have for decades, to clarify their employment status in the employment court?
Mr. Speaker, we are not removing the courts from New Zealand. However, what this government is intending to clarify for all businesses and workers is what the law and the intention under the law and the intention of this government is when it comes to businesses and their arrangements with contractors and workers. Parliament sets the laws which the courts follow.
Supplementary, does she acknowledge that minimum wage workers are particularly vulnerable to exploitation through working as contractors, and if so, will she ensure they are able to clarify their employment status in the employment court?
Mr. Speaker, as I have suggested earlier, I have only received very early policy scoping advice on the contracting arrangements. This is very early in my work program, and I'm very excited to clarify the law about the role of contracting arrangements and employment law arrangements within existing New Zealand law. I think it's very important to note that we want all businesses to thrive, we want all workers to thrive, and it's very important that we're giving clarity for both workers and businesses about what their rights and their obligations and their opportunities are in New Zealand's economy.
Supplementary. Does she recognise...
Hang on, supplementary question, Ronald was...
Could I ask the Minister whether she believes that it is sound industrial relations to clarify one's employment status before they commence a job, not halfway through when there's a dispute?
Thank you for the question. I think it's very important for everybody to know what they are signing up to under the law. And there are many, many people who sign contracting arrangements every day who are very satisfied with the terms of their contracts. 90% of people who are in contracting arrangements are satisfied or very satisfied with being self-employed and not being employees. And we should uphold their rights to continue to be contractors.
Elementary. Does she recognise that employees treated as contractors have included people such as the Glory Vale workers who worked full-time from age 6 years old and were able to protect their rights because they were deemed employees by the Employment Court?
Mr. Speaker, when it comes to the issue of Glory Vale, the Labour Inspectorate is there to help Glory Vale understand their obligations when it comes to Employment Law and Employment Relations Act. I think it's very important that we're looking at this from all across New Zealand, that everybody knows what their obligations are, they know what their rights are under the law, and where there is any form of exploitation, that the relevant authorities are notified so that everybody has their rights upheld under our Employment Relations Act.
Supplementary question, Camilla Billich.
Does the Minister agree that it is sometimes the case that during an employment relationship the nature of the work will change and it may be necessary to seek clarification at an employment court or on the authority? And will this policy be maintained despite her commitment to change the law in relation to contractors?
Mr. Speaker, as I've suggested, I'm in very early scoping work about the changes to clarify the law for the Employment Relations Act, and I look forward to the member being part of that consultation and bringing her views in the relevant time.
Supplementary. Does she think it's bad that people at Gloria Vale who work from 6 years old full time were able to clarify their employment status in the Employment Court?
Mr. Speaker, I would also like to note this question was regarding the advice that I've received on the coalition agreement's commitments. We are not changing anything specifically in the coalition agreement to do with Gloria Vale. However, where employment law fits within my purview for the coalition agreement, which is to clarify the intent that Parliament sets for employment relations, for contracting arrangements, and for employment agreements, this government will be clarifying that law. I only at this stage have very early policy scoping advice. However, I expect more advice to follow, and I look forward to engaging with the member at a further date.
Question number 7, the name of Dr. Vanessa Wenick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Science, Innovation and Technology, what recent announcement has she made in the Science, Innovation and Technology portfolio?
Judith Cox.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday I was pleased to announce the establishment of a science system advisory group. This group will help us explore the well-documented issues facing the science sector and will be chaired by Professor Sir Peter Gluckman, who will also chair the University Advisory Group appointed by the Minister for Tertiary Education and Skills, the Honourable Penny Simmons. The Science System Advisory Group has been tasked with delivering two reports, the first in June 2024 and the second in October 2024. It will form the basis of what is needed to enable this government to bring about the changes needed to ensure the science and higher education systems are well placed to deliver maximum benefit for the country and its people.
That's right. Very good.
Supplementary. Why is this needed?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The issues facing the science sector are very well documented. Science, innovation, technology are critically important to rebuilding the New Zealand economy. And with a country of our size and with the limited human and financial capital and markets, we need to focus our approach to science and innovation. Unfortunately, the status quo is not working. We have great scientists and innovators, but we as a government must ensure that taxpayer money is being spent wisely in creating benefits for the economy. And this advisory group will address these issues and provide us with advice.
How will the Science System Advisory Group tie in with the University Advisory Group?
Well, we understand the critical link between our universities and science and the CRIs, and for too long these sectors have not had the synergy required and have been disjointed in the way that they operate. It is critical that we get these two sectors working in conjunction with each other to ensure that we can turn research excellence into global impact. And while the two advisory groups will operate separately, having the same chair of each group will ensure that any changes made can benefit both science and higher education sectors.
What goals does she have for the portfolio?
So many goals, Mr. Speaker. But right now, there are real opportunities for New Zealand in areas of emerging and existing research, such as space and aerospace, biotechnology, quantum technology, advanced materials and medical technology, alongside other areas of strength and high potential. But commercialisation is essential to the success of science, innovation and technology. And the government will support more partnerships between the public and private sectors to see better outcomes from the amazing science research being done in New Zealand. We will also deliver on our election promise of establishing a dedicated gene technology regulator, investigating changes to employee stock ownership plan taxation, and delivering tech visas to get the best talent to New Zealand.
That's right.
Oh, I knew she was. See?
Supplementary, if you like it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How much will the Professor Sir Peter Gluckman Science System Advisory Group review and reports cost?
Oh, thank you very much for that question. I've had a look at that, and it's actually about just over $400,000 for the entire system, which is pretty amazing considering that was pretty much what one government agency might have spent on gifts for its outgoing CEO. Andrew.
That's right.
How is this supplementary? How is this not a waste of the time and effort put in by the science sector in fully documenting the issues in the sector and developing a plan which was contained in the 2022 Te Ara Pairangi Future Pathways White Paper?
Well, thank you so much again for that question. That Te Ara Pairangi was frankly a waste of paper. In fact, the forestry people should have taken back the money. It was really a shame because I was looking for something that didn't just say, oh, everything's going really well and we just keep doing a bit more of it. Nothing in there about where we need to be. So that was a waste of space. This is actually about getting things done. And unlike a previous minister in this role, I actually get stuff done.
Question number eight, the Honourable Jenny Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police.
Just hold on for a minute. No one's in a hurry today, it would seem. Okay, where you go.
Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Which minister in the government has primary responsibility for delivering 500 police officers within 2 years?
Myself as the police minister.
Why then did his office inform the Herald that Casey Costello holds primary...
Just start again. There will be silence when people ask a question.
Why then did his office inform the Herald that Casey Costello held responsibility for delivering 500 in 2 years?
Because the Honourable Casey Costello is my associate and she is assisting me as part of her delegation in the delivery of the 500. And I think it's fair recognition of her that the last 1800 was a great New Zealand first policy, and the next 500 is another great New Zealand first policy.
Will he confirm and put on the record that the response he gave, his office gave to the Herald, that Casey Costello held primary responsibility for delivering the 500 in 2 years was incorrect and false?
Well, I think the member's getting a bit hung up on the word of primary. I can assure her that myself and my very competent associate will be working together to deliver the 500 police officers over the next 2 years.
Self-interested question.
I asked the Minister how long did it take him to authenticate that they're not 1,800, but the 2,338 extra police officers was in fact New Zealand First work and not Labour's, as they claimed.
Well, that's a very good question, Mr. Speaker. Labour claimed New Zealand First policy of 1,800 additional police officers, and then as...
Yeah, I know where you're going to go. Just make your point of order. Honourable Karen McAnulty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The question in itself, it's questionable whether that was in order. Whether there's ministerial responsibility on which party claims success for watch and whether that's accurate or not, clearly isn't the responsibility of the police minister. And immediately upon attempting to answer it, it was straight into against the ruling that you made to this House just earlier this week.
That's right. And the question, though, was in order because it asked him about how long it had taken him to assess, which is not an unreasonable question. Words matter, if I may quote one of your former colleagues. And on the answer, it's not appropriate to start out with an attack on a previous government, but it is okay to reflect on the content of the question.
Mr. Speaker, it didn't take me very long at all to assess the fact that to understand who was responsible for the policy around the 1,800 additional police officers for our police service. And it didn't take me long to understand and work out that, in fact, they only delivered 1,500 because 300 were authorised officers.
Does he agree with police advice released under the Official Information Act that retaining non-sworn staff will be important and necessary in order to deliver 500 police within 2 years?
Yes, I agree. Non-sworn staff have a critically important role to play in police.
Will he commit to not cutting or reducing any non-sworn roles within police before this financial year and next financial year in order to enable police pay to deliver a 6.5% cut and also make sure the 500 are delivered?
Well, firstly, it's not a 6.5% cut. We have, as an incoming government, it became obvious, although we had very clear ideas, that that you have left, or the government, the previous government, has left a shambles behind. You are economic, or the previous government are economic vandals. Well, the previous government, Megan Woods might get upset about it, but the fact of the matter is, you've been economic vandals. The books are a shambles. So what we've had to do is the incoming government, and we've been very clear with our chief executives, including the commissioner, is we've asked them to go and look for where there are savings. Because the country accepts the fact that under the previous government, there has been a bloated bureaucracy, an enormous amount of investment, not much to show for it, and actually we have been responsible with taxpayers' money. Now, in terms of the police, we have been very clear that we're going to be focused on delivering stronger, better frontline services that actually provide better services to the member of the public as they should expect.
Is the Minister going to take, and has he been advised to take, a very practical, common sense, experienced view to his administration rather than dreaming pie in the sky stuff?
Good question. Yes.
Should be a very brief answer, I think.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Well done.
Jenny
Anderson.
Is it true that Winston Peters called you and asked you to take back the responsibility and not delegate it?
That is absolutely not true.
Question number 8. Oh, point of order. Right on, Winston Peters.
If we're going to have people getting up and talking about how this house should be run in question time, asking a question without any authority or any record, any authenticity, is just plain outside of standing orders. And therefore, I'm raising the point of order to ask her to apologise for that.
Well, given the tenure of the day, that is probably... Hang on a minute. We would be here all day apologising if every member wanted to be apologised to. Can I just say that, the question itself might have been wide, it is in line with the opening question, which was, does he stand by all his statements and actions? So the question is okay. We'll move now to question 9. James Meagher.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for Building and Construction. What announcements has he made on removing red tape in the building system?
The Honourable Chris Hink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today I announce that the government is cutting all that damn red tape. Thank you. Arguments in favour of retaining existing settings simply do not hold water. Dam safety regulations imposed by the previous government are set to come into force on the 13th of May. But farmers and growers have warned us about the downstream effects, which include an unreasonable amount of compliance cost for the relatively low risk posed by small dams that are used in farms across New Zealand for water storage. This week, the Coalition Government has agreed to raise the height threshold of the dams caught by regulations from 1 metre to 4 metres.
Supplementary. What impact will these changes have?
Mr. Speaker, these change will mean around 1,900 fewer dams will be impacted by the new regulations, reducing compliance costs by more than $13.3 million. It will also better align dam safety regulations with the requirement for dams over 4 metres also to have a building consent. This higher threshold strikes a balance between managing risk while easing the regulatory burden faced by owners of smaller dams, such as farmers and growers.
Oh, supplementary. What feedback has he received on these changes from regional New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, the feedback's been extremely positive. By extraordinary coincidence, it was from the member's very own electorate of the Maitea Rangatata that we have heard farmers there saying that they were attempting to comply with the regulations at the cost of some $5,000 each, not to mention the additional ongoing compliance burden and administrative costs. On-farm water storage is crucial for supporting greater resilience, particularly with the impact of extreme weather events such as droughts. Rather than making life harder for rural New Zealand, this government is making it easier.
Well said.
Is the government planning on making more announcements on removing building red tape?
Why, yes, Mr. Speaker. This government is focused on reducing costs and removing unnecessary red tape so that we can get the economy back on track. You can expect to hear a lot more on how the Coalition government is going to remove unnecessary regulations that are merely adding costs and getting in the way of Kiwis trying to build.
Question number 10 in the name of Steve Abel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question is to the Minister of Oceans and Fisheries. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Aye. Supplementary. Does he stand by his statements that the fishing industry, quote, deserve respect, and that he would, quote, stand up for people who regard fisheries as part of their birthright, and does he therefore share the opposition of fishers to seabed mining that totally destroys the seabed with flow-on impacts to fisheries?
So, yeah. I've gone from the champion of the provinces to the leader, the leading politician who is going to ensure that the fishing industry is not demonised or driven out of existence by stupid green policies.
Mr. Speaker, I have a point of order on that response, please.
A point of order, Stephen.
The question was quite specifically about whether he shared the opposition of fishers to seabed mining that totally destroys the seabed with flow-on impacts to fisheries.
And I don't believe it was answered.
Have another crack at that.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order.
That question had multiple limbs, and I responded to one of those limbs relating to my status as the Fisheries Minister. And I repeat again, the answer that I've given adequately covered one of the limbs of what was an octopus-like question.
Supplementary. When meeting with mining lobbyist Stratera on the 23rd of January on the resources and associate energy portfolio, did he, in his capacity as fisheries minister, communicate the long-standing opposition of the fishing industry to seabed mining?
Yeah, that's right. Just try again to get it in, inside the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries portfolio.
Okay.
Just hang on. We don't talk while this question being asked or about to be.
Does the Minister for Oceans and Fisheries share the opposition of fishers to seabed mining that totally destroys the seabed with flow-on impacts to fisheries?
Let's figure. There are some apocryphal, unfounded, dangerous assertions in that question. The processes that are in play pertaining to applicants seeking to gain access to the $500 billion worth of wealth on the bed of the sea are entitled to go through that process. And that is shared space enjoyed also by quota owners.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Steve Abel.
I don't believe he answered the question, which was specifically about whether he shared the opposition of the fishing industry to seabed mining.
Well, look, I think it's one of those ones earlier that I spoke of earlier. If you have a look at a speaker's ruling I'm leaning heavily on today, it's 2072. And I think in consideration of that, the Minister has addressed the question. Ask another sub.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the decision to cancel progress of the Kermadec Sanctuary, did he consult with interested and impacted iwi, such as Ngāti Kuri, before making this decision?
Honourable Chair Jones.
The decision that the member refers to is a decision of the Cabinet. In terms of talking to the associate iwi, it may involve me talking to myself. That is a decision endorsed by the entirety of the Cabinet. And it reflects the fact that nothing in the Kermadec, Mr. Speaker, will change as a consequence of the overdue decision today, whether it's noddies on land or puffer fish at the sea.
We move now to question number 11.
Point of order, I think I have one more supplementary, Mr. Speaker.
Oh, my apologies, sorry, I thought you were leaning back
amazement, but I do have a supplementary. Does he support the view of the International Seabed Authority that it strongly recommend a pause on seabed mining until there is a clear understanding of the impacts of the industry, that the industry may have on the marine environment, its living resources, and those dependent on them?
Speaker.
Honourable Shane Jones.
Obviously, within our domestic jurisdiction, there are opportunities to excavate, extract, and take rare earth seabed minerals necessary for the climate change journey.
Are you speaking as Fisheries Minister?
There is also the New Zealand involvement in a working group under the UN dealing with high seas international waters mining. The latter does not drive the former.
Now to question number 11, the name of Rachel Brookett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment. Does she stand by all her statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Penny Simmons.
Yes.
Supplementary. Does she regret that the Minister for the Environment is not listed as a decision-making minister in the Fast-Track Approvals Bill when those decision-making ministers can override Resource Management Act prohibited activities?
No.
Supplementary. Does she regret that the Minister and Ministry for the Environment have not been involved in work to extend marine consents by 25 years under the Resource Management Act?
No.
Supplementary. Does she regret contacting the Otago Regional Council to slow down its water plan to improve water quality?
Mr. Speaker, I contacted the Otago Regional Council to release them from the obligation that had been placed on them by the previous Minister for the Environment to ensure that I extended the date for their statutory deadline for notifying their freshwater planning instrument so that it was in line with all other councils.
Supplementary. Does she regret the potential for extended marine protection today being taken off the table for the Kermadec Islands?
The Kermadec Islands have already got a considerable amount of protection, and I'll list it for the member. So there is a marine reserve around each Kermadec Island out to 12 nautical miles. There are regulations prohibiting bottom trawling. There are a minerals reservation prevents new mining permits. And there are a range of marine wildlife regulations. There are already a range of protections in place.
Supplementary. Does she regret accepting the environment portfolio when she is powerless to protect the environment?
I reject that assertion.
Question number 12, in the name of Maria Memo Kapakingi.
Tēnā tātou.
And we will be quiet.
Tēnā tātou te whare. My question is to the Minister of Mental Health. What is his response to the rate of suspected suicide, which, according to Te Whatu Ora's data for 2022, is 51.9% of 100,000 for Māori males aged 25 to 44 years, compared to 16.4 per 100,000 for non-Māori males.
The Honourable Casey Costello.
On behalf of the Minister of Health, I can respond that any loss of a young life is an unspeakable tragedy. The suicide rates in New Zealand are unacceptably high and disproportionately affect some groups in New Zealand, including Māori men. That's why this coalition government is so focused on improving access to mental health.
What evidence-based initiatives that specifically address suicide rates is the Minister considering in the next five-year Suicide Prevention Action Plan, and how will these address the disparities of suicide rates between Māori and non-Māori?
Mr. Speaker, the work on the next Suicide Prevention Action Plan has just started. To set the direction of priorities and clear owners and accountability for the next five-year period. This coalition government is committed to reducing suicide rates in New Zealand. That's why we've established the first mental health portfolio. As Minister for Mental Health, this role will bring a clear focus for mental health and addiction and suicide prevention for all New Zealanders. We're working with our coalition partners to fund frontline services such as Gumboot Friday and I Am Hope Charity. This government is also working to establish the Mental Health Innovation Fund to increase access to mental health services in this term of government.
Supplementary.
Maria Memo.
What procurement process, therefore, was used for the I Am Hope Trust to receive $6 million of public money?
Mr. Speaker, I do not have the information to hand. I'm sure the Minister will be able to respond in writing.
Supplementary, therefore, has the I Am Hope Trust, who provide free counselling in schools, making a difference to the inequity of youth suicide rates between Māori and non-Māori, which was 34.1 per 100,000 for rangatahi Māori, compared to 16.9 for non-Māori youth?
Mr. Speaker, I'm unable to provide that specific information, but if the member would put it in a written question, I'm sure the minister could respond.
Takatai Tashki.
What Māori-specific initiatives is the minister funding with regard to suicide prevention?
Mr. Speaker, as I've stated before, the coalition government is committed to reducing suicide rates in New Zealand and better health outcomes for all New Zealanders. This is why we're focused on delivering of services close to home and as close to hapū as possible.
Fortunately, Māori are New Zealanders, which is a good thing. Does the minister accept, therefore, that... I was purely responding to the all New Zealander comments, excuse me, Mr.
Speaker.
We're going
to do all of that again because there's too much noise.
Does the Minister accept?
No little commentary at the start would be most in order.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Minister accept that colonisation and racism are a leading contributor to high suicide rates for Māori?
Mr. Speaker, I cannot speak for the Minister himself, but no, I don't accept that assertion.
Question.
Supplementary.
What is his view on the impacts of statements by government ministers that marginalise rangatahi from their whakapapa, such as comparing Māori and Pacifica spaces to apartheid and segregation on the mental health of rangatahi?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the assertion of that question.
I will state again, we've said we will bring healthcare for all New Zealanders closer to home and closer to community. This will serve Māori and non-Māori well.
I'll just make the point too that last supplementary was quite a distance from the primary, which is something we tend not to do. That concludes oral questions.